I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a few minutes, our conversation, the Wall Street Journal calls it baffling. Why does Rudy Giuliani have such a commanding lead among socially conservative Republicans? We'll take a closer look. But first, a huge storm is hampering attempts to contain and clean up that massive oil spill in the Strait of Kerch in southern Russia. On Sunday, in the midst of the storm, a single-hulled river tanker out on the seas split apart, spilling 1,300 tons, nearly 560,000 gallons of oil. This comes on the heels of a California Bay oil spill last week. Joining us from Moscow is Christian Science Monitor reporter Fred Weir. Fred, we're hearing words like disaster and environmental catastrophe. Put this spill in Russia in context for us.
Well, it certainly is the worst ever oil spill in and around Russia, and there have been quite a few. This is a big oil-producing country. This particular spill is enormous, and environmentalists, all the activists are down there, and I've talked to a couple of them today. They are just in despair about the extent of the spill, and they say it's going to get much worse because the storm continues unabated, and it's spreading the oil all over Russia's Black Sea coast.
Well, 30,000 seabirds are now coated in oil, we're hearing. And there are some political obstacles as well as the weather. Russia and Ukraine have long disputed who has control over the waterway where this spill is. How is that impacting the cleanup?
Well, right now the storm is the biggest problem, but down the road there is a territorial dispute running down the middle of that strait. It's a narrow waterway. On one side is Ukraine, and the other side is Russia, and they nearly came to blows a couple of years ago over a sandbar in the middle of it, and one hopes that they can put these differences aside. They want to string a boom across the strait to prevent oil from drifting into the Sea of Azov nearby. This would be crucial because that's a very, very delicate ecosystem there.
Tell us more about the boat that was crushed by the storm. It was not double-hulled, as American ocean tankers are now required to be after the Exxon Valdez accident. It was a river tanker. Why was that being used?
You see, this is a big problem in Russia, that oil prices are high. This is the biggest export for Russia, and it is trying to export as much oil as it possibly can. The Volga Neft 139 was a river boat. It had no business being in the open sea at all, but it's been pressed into service as part of this program of expanded oil exports. And a lot of the environmentalists are pointing to these kind of violations and saying they're widespread in Russia's transport system, and the pipelines are in bad shape. And, of course, the storm, it is the worst storm in many decades. Apparently 11 ships are known to have sunk in this storm. Now it is in itself a disaster, but all these human errors have greatly compounded it. And the use of shipping that is simply not appropriate for those conditions, of course, aggravates it a lot.
Well, not just that it was a ship that wasn't strong enough that was ferrying the oil, but the ship's captain, in these weather conditions, 18-foot waves, perhaps shouldn't have tried the pass.
Yes, apparently, in addition to everything else, they ignored storm warnings that were clearly relayed to them by the weather service in the Crimean Peninsula. They saw the winds coming up and warned the shipping in the Kerch Strait, and these ships simply paid no heed.
Fred, we've been talking about the environmental cost. There's, of course, a human cost as well. Three sailors' bodies have washed ashore. 20 are still missing. Searches were called off because of the dangerous weather that's also impeding the cleanup. Is it thought that those lives are lost?
Well, hope is running out for those sailors, and it's amazing, in fact, given the weather conditions, that 35 sailors were actually saved. This is another aspect to this tragedy, no doubt.
Fred Weir of the Christian Science Monitor speaking to us from Moscow. Fred, thanks so much.
It's my pleasure.
In the presidential race, national polls show Republican Rudy Giuliani still holding double-digit leads over his closest GOP rivals. And he's running neck and neck when paired against Democrats Hillary Clinton, John Edwards, and Barack Obama. And last week, Giuliani surprised many by winning the endorsement of conservative televangelist Pat Robertson. How did a New Yorker who backs gun control, gay rights, and abortion rights for others, who's had three wives and a very public divorce, whose kids are estranged. How did he manage that? The Wall Street Journal writes, Giuliani's ability to sustain his lead is striking, almost baffling. So today, in our ongoing look at the candidates, a closer look at Rudy Giuliani. In a few minutes, a reporter who's been out on the campaign trail with him and says he thinks Giuliani uses tough love with the voters, but that he's built an image as the toughest guy on the block. But first, a reporter who's studied Giuliani in New York and says that reputation is perhaps undeserved. Wayne Barrett is a Giuliani biographer and senior editor of the Village Voice newspaper. He's reported some of the hardest-hitting stories on Mayor Giuliani's mayorship. And most recently, he expanded his reporting in the book Grand Illusion, The Untold Story of Giuliani and 9/11. Wayne, welcome.
Glad to be here.
Remind ourselves, Giuliani's a former federal prosecutor, the first Republican in decades to be elected mayor of New York. He was called America's mayor for his response to the terror attacks on 9/11. Remind us, let's start with just reminding us some of those images that Americans saw on 9/11 and after.
Well, I call it his Iwo Jima moment. It's this visual that I think is embedded now in the American mind of him walking through the canyons of lower Manhattan, pointing north, covered in soot, the man who stood up the day we were attacked. And I think really it's that image that transcends all the other negatives that might ordinarily hamper a candidate, the ones you've mentioned.
Giuliani backers say he has every right to campaign on those images. He earned it that day. The Wall Street Journal and others are saying that Giuliani's success is a sign that for Republicans, that image of strength is trumping social issue questions. But you say what about that image?
Well, it's kind of the ultimate irony. No one would say, and I've known him since 78 and covered him as a prosecutor, no one would say he's a dumb man. He's a very smart man, but probably the dumbest thing he ever did was put the command center, the emergency command center, in the only complex that had already been attacked by terrorists in 1993, the World Trade Center complex. It was a decision that was resisted by all of his top security advisors, one of whom, the police commissioner, called it ground zero in 1997 because it had already been attacked and urged him not to put it there. But he insisted on putting it there. And, of course, that's the reason he was at the scene of the crime that day. I mean, most Americans think here's a guy who rushed to the scene of the attack when actually, by his own account in his book Leadership, he jumped in the car and was headed to the command center, which was located at 7 World Trade. Bernie Kerik, the police commissioner, was standing in front of 7 World Trade waiting for him. And by the time he got down there, they had already issued a vacate order for that building. So we had no functioning command center that day. One of the things we lay out in the book, and we do it with quotations from virtually every person, including the senior attorney who oversaw the 9/11 Commission chapter, it's chapter 9, that deals with the city's response, and all of them told us that the decision to locate the command center at 7 and the consequence of not having a functioning command center that day cost first responder lives.
Well, take off some of the other things that you say that mistakes Giuliani makes, even as he now campaigns as someone who's not just tough on terror but a security expert. And you've written that, you know, you think those claims are bunk, in fact, big lies, as you call them. You know, just tick off some of your criticisms.
Well, I recently reported a story in The Voice from Giuliani's private testimony before the 9/11 Commission, which is sealed until December of 2008, strangely enough. But I got a copy of it, and his own testimony contradicts the way he portrays himself. This is testimony he delivered to two members of the commission and five staff members on April 20th of 2004. And whereas he now goes around the country saying, Bin Laden declared war on us, nobody heard him, but I heard him. I understood it. That's almost a direct quote. It's a fair paraphrase of his comments at Regent University, Pat Robertson's university. And he describes himself as an expert on terrorism who's been studying it for 35 years. In his private testimony in 2004, he says, the first time I ever had a briefing on Al-Qaeda was after 9/11. He describes the briefings in detail that he received from a man named Yosef Bodansky, who wrote a book about bin Laden that was published in 1999 and predicted a spectacular attack on New York and Washington in 1999. But he's reading the book and being briefed by Bodansky in the fall of 2001 after 9/11. And he says in the private testimony, it was a mistake. We're unlikely to hear that on the campaign trail.
Well,
but he says it was a mistake for him not to have been briefed earlier.
There's a long list of criticisms that you have, including that he didn't investigate and prosecute terror cases, as he claimed, that he wasn't prepared for the second World Trade Tower attack, as you've just said, even though the first one gave plenty of warning to people, didn't set up the first Office of Emergency Management until 3 years after that, and, as we said, put the control center in the worst place, didn't make the radios interoperable between the fire and the police. But I'm just wondering, Wayne, if all of this is true and your writing has, you know, been applauded, why aren't his opponents attacking him on this?
Well, I think we're beginning to see that from John McCain. I think McCain is the candidate with the greatest credibility to raise these questions, considering his own record. And McCain, when he announced the first time many months ago, he had a reference to the fact that the radios were not interoperable and how unacceptable that was. The New York Times went up on its website that afternoon saying it was a clear shot at Giuliani, though he didn't use Giuliani's name. I was on Keith Olbermann's show that night and said the same thing, but by the morning, McCain's people were pulling back and saying, no, he was talking about a federal regulatory agency. He was not referring to Giuliani.
Well, in fact,
the Federal Communications Commission gave the city a unique waiver to get additional frequencies so it could make the radios interoperable between police and fire. They did that in 95, and Rudy never acted on
it. Well, I'm wondering, too, if it's not the 9/11 commissioners, at least two of them, wrote that they didn't ask Rudy Giuliani tough questions because they didn't want to criticize a hero. I wonder if there's something of that going on. But also, if it matters to the voters. We've got a couple minutes left, and I just want to, you know, ask you about perception, because we hear your criticisms, but people perceive him as a leader. And a recent poll found that 77% of voters in New Hampshire viewed him favorably. There's some validity to people feeling that they feel strength from Rudy Giuliani and feel that he led on 9/11?
Well, you know, the president was missing in action. Rudy Giuliani was there. The visual can't be denied. He said all the right things both that day and in the immediate aftermath. So the question is, do any of the facts matter as to what he actually did, contrary to both the image and the rhetoric of the day and the days afterwards? Does there any of the facts about the failures to prepare the city, about his complete ignorance about terrorism, even though his was the city that had been attacked, will any of these facts matter? And they will only matter if opponents raise them, opponents with credibility like McCain, who seems to be beginning to take on Giuliani. He certainly took him on the Kerik indictment very frontally in the last few days.
Mm-hmm.
Or if the media raises them. And the print media, the Washington Post, has done a fairly good story raising some of these questions. But most of the print media has shrunk from this. And the television media is still tied up in the mythology that they helped create.
That's Wayne Barrett, Village Voice, and also author of Grand Illusion, The Untold Story of Rudy Giuliani and 9/11. Wayne, thanks so much.
Great talking to you.
And when we come back, Rudy Giuliani out on the campaign trail. We'll speak with a reporter who's there. That's after a one-minute break here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're continuing our look at Republican presidential candidate Rudy Giuliani, who's leading his Republican rivals by double digits in national polls, even though former Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney tops Giuliani in the early voting states of Iowa and New Hampshire. With us on the line now, a Los Angeles Times political correspondent Peter Walston, co-author of the book One Party Country, The Republican Plan for Dominance in the 21st Century. And Peter, your thoughts, first of all, on Wayne Barrett's conclusion that, you know, Rudy Giuliani has sort of like a fake front of being a terrorism expert, and it's if his opponents start, you know, pricking at that, he will fall.
Well, I'll certainly defer to Wayne's excellent reporting on Giuliani's record in New York. But yes, I mean, I think that there are some potential weaknesses there that his opponents could pick up on over the course of the campaign, although they haven't yet. There are indications that, and if you look at the polls, Giuliani is leading all the national polls, but his support is pretty soft. What we found in our LA Times polls recently, both in the early states and nationally, is that although Giuliani leads, a big majority of Republicans are willing to change their vote. And Giuliani, although he leads, he really has never gotten out of the low 30s. It's such a crowded field. It's a very fluid situation in the Republican primary. So low 30s is hardly dominant. It's not like what we've seen on the Democratic
side
with Hillary Clinton.
But it's more than double the 16% who favor John McCain or the 15% who back Fred Thompson in a Wall Street Journal NBC News poll. And Mitt Romney's back at fourth nationally. But you're out on the trail with Giuliani, and you've written some interesting things. I mean, he talks like a New Yorker to people in other parts of the country. Very, 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 what's the word I'm looking for? Very tough love. Give us some examples.
Well, it's interesting. You know, I went out with him recently to New Hampshire, to the North Country, which is pretty rural. And I had read a few stories elsewhere that Giuliani had softened himself, and he was chuckling and laughing, and he was trying to change his image a little bit. So I expected something different, but you know, I got there and followed him around to various small towns, and there was one example in the morning of that day that I was with him. He got a question from a 9-year-old girl about, as she put it in a very interesting way. She said, "What about the damages?" And he just kind of looked at her and said, "What are you talking about? Lawsuit reform?" And she said, no, the damages, like, you know, 9/11. She was talking about the damage from terrorist attacks. And he kind of started waving his finger and talking about how the Democrats are afraid to use the term Islamic terrorism. It was kind of a strange approach to a discussion with a 9-year-old girl.
Yeah, you would think a candidate might take the opportunity to comfort her.
Yeah, it was. You would think that somebody who was a little bit more, I guess, deft in that, with that personal touch.
Well, you know, and yet that's maybe, you know, sort of the tough guy that some people are embracing. We're seeing reports everywhere that this is what's happening with Giuliani candidacy, that his perceived strength is trumping things like social issues. Mm-hmm. But we're also reading that voters polled have said they're concerned that Giuliani is running based on 9/11, has little experience on foreign policy. His senior foreign policy advisor, none other than Norman Podhoretz, who has been described as the intellectual guru of neoconservatives. They, of course, supported the war in Iraq. And there's, you know, you wonder, will, you know, he be ideologically linked with what is an unpopular war and the administration behind it?
Well, he may be, although I think that that's an issue that might be more of a concern during the general election. None of the Republican candidates, none of the top Republican candidates, I should say, is really distancing themselves from Bush's foreign policy at the moment. Really, the only criticism we've seen on the Bush foreign policy in a broad sense is from Giuliani, who says that Bush hasn't been tough enough on Pakistan's government. That's not something that the Republican primary voters are going to punish him for. In fact, what polls seem to suggest that, as you mentioned earlier to Wayne, national security issues are trumping cultural issues in the Republican primary, and that's unusual.
Well, again, and this is the Wall Street Journal NBC News poll, he leads his contenders among self-identified very conservative Republicans and weekly churchgoers. He's tied with McCain and Thompson among evangelicals, even though he's had a very public divorce, a third wife. As we mentioned, he is personally against abortion, but pro-choice, pro-gay rights. Mm-hmm. And we're wondering, too, when, as a candidate, is a candidate required, you know, sort of like by some unwritten rule in America, to begin discussing his family life? Because his personal story goes back further. Wayne, who we were just speaking to, Wayne Barrett, uncovered that his father and uncles had ties to organized crime. His father sent to prison for robbing a milkman with a baseball bat. His father had been an enforcer for bookies and loan sharks. And Giuliani said he didn't know of these things, and he became an enforcer, you know, a prosecutor. When does that story... Is it required that he somehow address that on the campaign trail?
It seems that a lot of people know, and again, we're talking in the context of a Republican primary at the moment, and we can talk about the general election later. But
well, there's not that much later, so put them both in now.
Well, it's just not hurting him, and we find that voters do know about that aspect of his history. They know about his they seem to know about his views on social issues. Maybe they don't know, they don't quite know yet that he's estranged from his kids. And the question there is, will an opponent or a third party group let the voters know. You know, I was talking to the South Carolina Republican chairman who was predicting that some third-party group would probably go up with TV ads in South Carolina sometime in the next 6 weeks or so, showing Giuliani dressed in drag.
Which he does quite often, apparently, at different events.
That's true. And now that's something that could hurt him with Republican primary voters once they see that.
Yeah. Peter Walston reports on politics for the Los Angeles Times. He's co-author of the book One Party Country, The Republican Plan for Dominance in the 21st Century. Just in the few seconds we have, Peter, looking ahead, what do you see ahead for the Giuliani campaign?
Well, again, they're going to keep on this strategy of strength, national security, trumping cultural issues.
And but winning the big states and foregoing the early primaries.
They're actually not going to forego the early primaries. They've decided they have to compete in New Hampshire. They cannot let Mitt Romney win Iowa and win New Hampshire and gain momentum. I think the Giuliani campaign has decided that would be too much to overcome. Yeah.
Peter Walston, thanks as always.
No, my pleasure.
Okay, quick look ahead. Should residents of Washington, D.C. be allowed to own a handgun? And will the Supreme Court weigh in on what the Second Amendment says about the individual rights to bear arms? That's still to come after the news here and now. The Supreme Court is considering whether or not to take up a case that would test the Second Amendment right to keep and bear arms. The basic question is, does the Second Amendment protect an individual's rights to keep and bear arms, or is that right tied to membership in a state militia? In 1939, the Court ruled in a criminal case that a sawed-off shotgun is not one of the arms included in the rights in the Second Amendment, but the court has been silent on the issue since then. Now the court is being asked to rule on a strict gun control law in the District of Columbia. The law bars all possession of handguns in homes. In March, a federal appeals court declared the D.C. ban unconstitutional. The District of Columbia appealed to the Supreme Court, and gun rights advocates couldn't be happier. They want the case to go all the way because they want to know, what does the Second Amendment mean? The case is the creation of Robert Levy. He's senior fellow in constitutional studies at the Cato Institute, the prominent libertarian think tank. He financed the original lawsuit challenging the D.C. law. He recruited the plaintiffs, and he joins us now with more. Welcome.
Nice to be with you.
Mr. Levy, your stand, you're against some forms of gun control. You interpret the Second Amendment as meaning an individual has the right to keep and bear arms. We want to hear more about that. But first, just tell us, how did you shape your case? How did you pick the plaintiffs to make the case one that you wanted to take forward?
There were actually three triggering events. One was an outpouring of scholarship on the Second Amendment, especially from liberals. The second was a holding by the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in a case in 2001 called United States v. Emerson. That was the first federal court of appeals to determine that the Second Amendment secured an individual right. And the third development was the supportive position taken by the U.S. Justice Department for the first time in formal court papers indicating that it, too, supported an individual rights view. With respect to the plaintiffs, we wanted gender diversity. We wanted racial diversity. We wanted economic and age diversity. Obviously, we wanted D.C. residents who believed fervently in gun rights and actually wanted loaded weapons in their homes because they felt threatened and had a need to defend themselves.
So these were not criminal cases, people caught with guns. The sole reason that these plaintiffs want to be involved in the case is that they want to be able to have guns in their home for self-defense.
The facts of these cases were compelling. Shelley Parker, the lead plaintiff, had her life threatened by drug dealers. Rich Heller carries a gun every day to guard a federal office building as a special police officer, but can't get a gun to take home to guard himself and his wife. Another plaintiff was a gay colleague of mine at the Cato Institute, and he had been accosted outside of D.C. by homophobic thugs who threatened his life and was only able to save himself because he happened to have a loaded gun in his backpack. He couldn't have done that in Washington, D.C.
What will it mean to you if the court does take this question up?
There have been arguments on both sides about whether gun laws make us less safe or make us more safe. I think the overwhelming amount of evidence says that the more gun laws we have, the worse off we are. But fundamentally, this case is not about that kind of empirical data. This is about the meaning of the U.S. Constitution, in particular, the meaning of the Second Amendment. There are Americans who want to be able to defend themselves all across the country, and they are waiting for the Supreme Court to issue a four-square pronouncement on what the Second Amendment means.
We're not going to debate the issue here. We want to find out more about you as a lawyer taking this, case before the Supreme Court. You're one of the co-lawyers on the case. But let me just throw out one thought. You're aware, I'm sure, of reports most recently from the Harvard School of Public Health with data from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention saying states with the greatest numbers of guns in the home also have the highest homicide rates, that a gun, for instance, might be more likely to move a situation from an argument to a killing or a murder. Now, square that with your thinking that, you know, more gun laws make us less safe.
Well, you know, this is a conflation of cause and effect. I mean, after all, stores with bars on the windows have more burglaries. That doesn't mean that the burglaries are caused by the bars. They put the bars on the window because they're in an area where burglaries occur. In the same fashion, people have guns when they're in an area where it's necessary to protect themselves, so it's not surprising. But I think the important thing is that two federal government agencies have examined exhaustively gun controls and found no statistically significant evidence to support their effectiveness. The National Academy of Sciences in 2004, and there was a similar study a year earlier by the Centers for Disease Control.
As you've written, you say that you believe the problem isn't guns, it's human pathology, problems like drug and alcohol abuse, dysfunction. And you go on to say banning and regulating guns isn't the solution. Enforcing existing laws is. And I want to ask you about that, because if in fact the Supreme Court rules that individuals do have a right to own guns, wouldn't that mean that many of the existing laws that you say should be upheld would be disbanded?
Some laws will be disbanded, but I don't think there's anybody who believes that you can't regulate some weapons like missiles and some people like kids and felons and crazy people and some uses like murder. The question is, what kinds of regulations can be sustained under an individual rights view of the Second Amendment? And clearly there are some regulations, like an outright ban in Washington, D.C., of all handguns that simply go too far.
What about states' rights? As a libertarian, isn't that important to you?
You know, the whole notion of the state-federal balance was changed in 1868 when the 14th Amendment was ratified. And so the 14th Amendment said the federal government would have a right to intervene if the states were violating fundamental rights, as, for example, those secured by the Bill of Rights. Well, the Second Amendment is part of the Bill of Rights, and if the states are violating the Second Amendment, then the federal government can step in and stop those violations from occurring.
So you're saying, you know, for instance, inner cities that feel they're having more gun trafficking, more issues with guns than, let's say, perhaps the suburbs that have a lower crime rate, you feel they don't have the right to call for their own gun bans?
Not for an outright gun ban. They do have the right to impose gun controls, just as they have the right, for example, to impose laws against shouting fire in a crowd theater or disturbing the peace. All of those are within the power of the states, even though the First Amendment says Congress shall pass no law.
But isn't this what Washington, D.C.? But isn't this what Washington, D.C. is doing? You know, that this is a city that feels that it needs to call for a gun ban?
Washington, D.C. has determined that no one in Washington, D.C. will have the right to own a handgun. That simply is an unreasonable regulation. Under no stretch of the Second Amendment could that be condoned.
How would you, if you think that cities that have issues and areas that have issues with gun violence have the right to legislate against guns, how would you word a gun ban in an area that would meet your satisfaction?
There are some things we can comfortably identify as being unacceptable and other things we can comfortably identify as being acceptable. Unacceptable is an outright ban that exists in Washington, D.C. Acceptable would be a ban, for example, on felons possessing guns or on kids having guns or crazy people possessing and using guns. Those regulations are acceptable. What an individual rights view of the Second Amendment does is it establishes a presumption that we have liberty to own guns. It doesn't mean government can't regulate. It does mean that government has to justify its regulations. Government can justify some regulations, but not all regulations. And one that they can't justify is the outright ban that exists in Washington, D.C.
Robert Levy, what will you do if the Supreme Court says it will not take up this question?
Well, this would be a victory for the residents of Washington, D.C., because it means that the Court of Appeals decision will become binding precedent in Washington. There's still the knotty question of whether or not the Second Amendment applies to the states. Washington, D.C. is not a state, so that question didn't come up in Washington, D.C.
And we'll have to perhaps wait another 70 years. Robert Levy, Senior Fellow in Constitutional Studies at the Cato Institute, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And this note, there was no word, yay or nay, today from the Supreme Court on whether they will take up Robert Levy's case and perhaps decide what the Second Amendment means. The next time we may hear on this issue is November. We'll, of course, cover it then. Before we go today, the good old days of punk rock in pictures. You're listening to Here and Now. Are you still looking for a farmer's market that's open in November, searching for a locally grown lettuce? Well, then you may be the word of the year. The new Oxford American Dictionary picks a word every year that they predict will be on everyone's lips. Ben Zimmer is the editor of the new Oxford American Dictionary. He joins us. And Ben, this year's winner is...
The winner is locavore.
Locavore. Spell it.
It's spelled L-O-C-A-V-O-R-E.
Define it.
It means someone who endeavors to eat only locally grown or locally produced foods.
There you go. And where did this word come from?
Well, unlike a lot of words that are sort of lost in the mists of time, this is one that we actually know exactly where it came from. There was a group of four women in San Francisco 2 years ago who issued a challenge to people in the Bay Area to try to only eat foods that were available to them that were grown within a 100-mile radius. Mm-hmm. And they called themselves the locavores. And soon after they issued this challenge, there were a lot of other regional groups that took up the cause. Some of them call themselves local vores, but the original form locavore seems to be the popular one, and it's really taken off since then.
Yeah, it's eating locally, trying to buy things locally. In fact, it sort of dovetails a little with last year's Word of the Year, which was the phrase carbon neutral, describing something that emits no carbon dioxide or offsets carbon emissions, because locavores believe that by eating locally, one of the things they do is reduce carbon emissions.
That's correct, because, of course, when you ship food over long distances, that requires more fossil fuel for transportation. So there's a strong environmental argument, but there's also just the argument of taste. Food that is fresh and local tastes better, and the proponents of this movement also say it's more nutritious.
Well, boy, you can tell it's a movement on the move because it just keeps popping out these new words. One of the runner-ups for this year is the word upcycle, which means what?
That's the transformation of waste materials into something more useful or valuable.
Am I sort of onto something here? We're going to be seeing more eco-friendly words popping up.
Well, that's definitely something that we've noticed here at Oxford University Press. The lexicographers who put the dictionaries together are finding that the green movement is having a tremendous effect on the vocabulary of the English language, on new words and phrases that people are using often to describe changes in lifestyle.
Well, you have to make up the words if they don't already exist. Let's take a look at some of the other runners-up. Aging in place, it's a phrase, but it feels like something I do when I don't get out enough. What aging in place is what?
Well, that's defined as the process of growing older while living in one's own residence instead of having to move to a new home or community. So it's a way, really, of providing more freedom to seniors to allow them to grow older while not having to move somewhere else.
Colony collapse disorder. This is the phenomenon that's resulted in the disappearance of honeybees.
Yes. I mean, this was something that still hasn't been explained by scientists, and this is certainly something that got a lot of coverage because it was first observed just in late 2006, and people are still trying to figure out where all the honeybees went.
Mumblecore?
Mumblecore is an interesting one. That's an American independent film movement by 20-somethings who are making low-budget movies using non-professional actors who have a lot of dialogue in the movies that's improvised. And one of the people in this group called it Mumblecore. This was mentioned at the South by Southwest Film Festival, and all of the journalists started writing about Mumblecore as this new American film movement.
There you go. Previvor, a person who has not been diagnosed with a form of cancer but has survived a genetic predisposition for cancer. That's an interesting word, but we want to close on one that we remember when this came into the lexicon. Tase, as in don't tase me, bro. To be stunned with a taser. There was that University of Florida student who was filmed being stunned by a taser at a public forum.
Yes, that's what we call a back formation, where you take the word taser and you create a verb out of it by turning it into tase, which has been spelled as either T-A-S-E or T-A-Z-E. And that definitely had a kind of a pop culture moment, helped along by YouTube video, where all of a sudden people were using that verb quite a lot.
Yeah. At YouTube, that's another one. Ben Zimmer is the editor of the New Oxford American Dictionary, looking at the words of 2007. The word of the year is locavore. Ben, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
And by the way, a moment ago I said the Supreme Court might next address that Second Amendment case in November. I should have added November 26th. Back in a minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. When the Sex Pistols began their reunion tour in the UK this past weekend, there was no swearing on stage at the request of the bass player because his young son was in the audience. Hard to believe from the band that marked Queen Elizabeth's Jubilee in 1977 by blasting "God Save the Queen, She Ain't No Human Being" from a chartered boat on the Thames. That stunt ended with a police raid, arrests, a disaster. In other words, a great punk success. Today, bands like Green Day and the Foo Fighters have gone mainstream with a revived punk, and Iggy Pop songs are used on commercials. But we want to look back at Johnny Rotten, the Cramps, the Damned, Debbie Harry, and the spirit that inspired punk with music writer Holly George Warren, author of Punk 365, a new brick of a big book of photographs from the brief and raucous era of punk. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
You know, I suppose we should just do a primer at the beginning. I mean, some people may, if they don't know the music, know the images, the ripped T-shirts, the safety pins, the mohawk haircuts. But just, you know, the years and the pre-punk, post-punk, just give us a little outline.
Right. For this book, I really wanted to give a few images from the pre-punk years that really affected not only the music, but also the look of punk. Even going back to the 60s, we have the Velvet Underground and their thing with, you know, love of black leather and songs about whips and things like that. Definitely helped to inspire some of the later imagery in the 70s with punk. But definitely in New York, we've got the early scene with Richard Hell, who started out with television and began doing the ripped T-shirts, and fortunately I was able to get Richard to actually write a foreword to the book. So,
and in his foreword, Richard Hell of Richard Hell and the Voidoids remembers that the original band, they were going to conquer the world, but instead they conquered themselves. They self-destructed. And he writes, the music was doomed to be enjoyed by connoisseurs. What do you think he means by that?
Well, at the time, it was really us against them because prog rock was so huge at the time.
Which rock?
Prog. Just the big, overblown, overproduced kind of sound, like everything from, you know, Rush to yes. King Crimson to Moody Blues. Mm-hmm. It just become kind of bombastic, and music had really moved away from that three-chord rock and roll, which was the early 50s original sound of rock and roll that came out of rockabilly and R&B. And that original rock and roll spirit is what fueled the punks, both in New York, then also in London, and then in L.A.
That's the sort of, you call it do-it-yourself, DIY, and it's Patti Smith, Lou Reed, pared-down sound.
Right. Well, Patti Smith was definitely one of the pioneers, even before punk, the term, became kind of a catchword. She was already, again, looking back to everything from the girl groups to early raw Rolling Stones before they became so pampered rock star types, you know, and putting forth emotion in the music and caring more about that than how well you could play some fancy guitar lead that went on interminably long.
You know, paging through, oh, look, there's the Joy Division on stage in 1979, new movie out about that group and the death of their lead singer, you know, he committed suicide. But,
right.
And there's the Buzzcocks, 1979. Look at Jonathan Richman. He looks like a baby. John Lydon, you know, they all look so young and fresh-faced. I mean, I don't think I saw it then. Now, they look like they're sort of young people trying, except for Iggy Pop, trying really hard to look harder.
There's even a couple of Iggy images where he still has a little certain innocence to him. But then if you go to the end of the book, when punk really was making inroads into all different kinds of music in the whole MTV era in the mid-80s, but then we still see Lou Reed, then he's still kind of a godfather of punk. The same thing with Iggy.
You include many of the people that we'd expect to see, you know, in a listing of punk bands, Susie and the Banshees, the Damned, the Detroit's MC5, but also the Beastie Boys, U2, Madonna. Some purists might, you know, maybe be shocked at that. What were you saying there?
by the 80s, certain elements of punk, mostly the image, but some of the other, the emotion, the anger, was seeping into other forms of music. So I wanted to show how that happened in the 80s and how even early Madonna, who was living like a punk, squatting at this place called the Music Building in New York City where punk bands rehearsed, wearing the black rubber bracelets, and, you know, the Desperately Seeking Susan era Madonna, definitely was inspired by the whole idea of punk, do-it-yourself. She moved here from Michigan. I'm going to start a band. And her original music was very punky. The same thing with people like Cyndi Lauper, her old band. It was kind of part of the punk movement. Very much so was influenced by ska and reggae.
B.S., here I go.
Beastie Boys, I can tell you, were a punk rock band. They were a hardcore band. Their very first ever EP, Pollywog Stew, was actually mixed in my St. Mark's Place apartment by my boyfriend at the time because the squat where they were recording got busted by the cops. So they were very much a hardcore band at the beginning, and then they segued into hip-hop as that started happening, you know, later on.
Boy, it was a good movement for women. Chrissy Hyde, the Go-Go's, the B-52s in part. You reminded of that when you paged through.
Exactly, and it wasn't only women for the first time populating an entire band, but also women were out there in the trenches taking photographs.
Is it something that's just nostalgia now, especially since I'm thinking I have a 3-year-old nephew who loves to get a mohawk, you know, everybody's got tattoos now, and is it something that just got co-opted or smoothed out and it's sort of gone?
Well, I think the image definitely got co-opted, just like back in my day when I was getting into the punk scene, you know, the whole original 50s rockabilly people, the slicked back pompadour hair and that kind of thing, that made its way into the punk scene as well. But I think as far as the actual really the hardcore scene, for example, which still lives on to an extent, and some of the harder, more stripped down, angrier kind of punk sound, which definitely still exists, I don't think that has actually been taken over by the mainstream. I think that's still separate, and especially now with the internet, there's this whole little subculture that exists of zines and recordings available on the internet of bands that are into that much more aggressive, much more dissonant kind of style than, you know, than what's has made it into, you know, radio airplay like the Green Days and even the Social Distortions and people like that.
There's so much to talk about in the punk movement that we didn't even once mention Sid and Nancy.
Oh. Romeo and Juliet of punk.
Yeah. Of course, both dying tragically. He killed her.
That's still argued about in punk circles. People still argue about if Sid really did kill Nancy.
Really?
Like, oh, yeah. There's all kinds of theories that she was actually murdered by someone else, and he was just so drug-addled that he, you know, didn't really know what happened. He couldn't remember anything. And, yes, of course, he ended up dying, and, you know, I think he really did love Nancy. I think they had this really twisted, sick relationship, but there was definitely, their little black hearts were in love.
Well, I guess we did mention Sid and Nancy. Holly George Warren is author of Punk 365, a new thick big book of photos from the brief but raucous era of punk. To see some of the pictures and links to videos from the time, go to our website, here-now.org. Holly, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me, Robin.
You can listen to Here and Now live each weekday at noon Eastern Time by going to WBUR.org and clicking on the Listen Live button. You can also find us each weekday at noon Eastern on XM Radio Channel 133.